Hi, everybody. I'm Carolyn Lovewell, and
I'm Layla Matthews.
And you're listening to the Sleep Over podcast. We have our illustrious husbands with us today. We have Rory Matthews.
Hello.
And David Lovewell.
Hello.
And also in the room is my stepson, Jabari, and my little baby, Solomon. And Lulu's around here somewhere, so you might hear kid and baby sounds.
Of children.
We're hanging out in my living room. We got snacky snacks. And Rory just finished reading one of my very favorite books, which is Promethea by Alan Moore, which I thought was a graphic novel, but Rory let me know that it is, in fact, a comic book. It's a collection of comic books. You can buy it in three volumes.
And there's nothing wrong with being an adult who reads comic books, because according to the CIA, comic books are the best way to learn stuff because it integrates and involves both hemispheres of your brain with images and pictures and symbols as well as words. So it's a great way to learn something.
I really love it when the CIA validates my spiritual journey, like the Monroe Institute and everything like that.
They know what's up.
They do know what's up. That's exactly how they're doing what they're doing. They're really good at that stuff. Okay. So, Rory, how about you kick off the conversation, because you're fresh. Oh, and you don't need to be that close to it. Oh,
okay. Yeah. I'll put it on the table. Okay.
You're also loud, baby.
I know. I'm so loud. Okay. Yeah, I just finished reading Promethea, and I was like, oh my God, this is possibly or definitely one of the most clear and fun, like, downloads of the Hermetic magic and Kabbalistic mysteries that I've read. Mm-hmm. And what a great, you know, I guess I was thinking about how it's one thing to sort of be familiar and have studied all those concepts already. And it's another thing. I wonder what it would be like for someone who has no preconceived notions or ideas about the Tree of Life or the Tarot or Babylon or Crowley to read Promethea. That's not my experience, but I was just very excited and really loved reading. You know, there's a whole issue where they go through every card in the major arcana and map it against like human history and development. And that was amazing. There's a whole volume where she climbs the Tree of Life. And then, I guess, spoilers, it ends with...
No spoilers.
Before
you're reading it.
Oh. Uh-oh. Okay. Well, how am I going to talk about some of this? I really liked the ending.
Maybe Jabari could go upstairs and read.
Well, how necessary is it? I mean...
I guess I don't have to spoil the details.
What if
you're
it
right,
doesn't
David?
Spoil the story to know some of the things, like that she's Babylon. I feel like it's hinted at even in the beginning.
And
of the
she's
first
an emanation. Book. Of
she's an
Babylon.
Emanation of Babylon.
That's,
yes,
that's pretty straightforward. That's...
Well, I guess the most compelling thing that I was thinking about. I mean, there's lots of compelling things, but the one I was most thinking about was something they explore in the story, and also the final issue, which is like an amazing synopsis of like all of these concepts and consciousness and human development, but the relationship between the lunar female Babylonian Promethea imagination principle,
the Yesodic realm,
but I think more than that too, and then the male like animal snake DNA kind of individual consciousness principle.
Yeah, the beast. The moon and the snake was sort of their metaphor for it and that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's the image on the universe card of the Babylon kind of dancing with the snake, and really like how the... I was really thinking about how it's kind of complete unconsciousness that makes a connection with this like imagination magic. And then that starts to bring it into consciousness, and it's a like path of that snake DNA amino acid entity person all the way up into full consciousness. And something I was talking to Layla about today that I thought was really interesting was I was like reading about the left-hand path as well, and the idea that that's kind of developing one's individual consciousness to a point where the whole universe responds to it. And it just made me think about how like the male and the female principles there, and the idea of penetration, and how there's like this infinitely small snake hadit principle that's like the sperm, and then there's the Babylon Nuit void infinite principle that's like the egg. and the sperm penetrates the egg and like affects that reality and like makes a huge change there, and how you have to be like so much smaller than something in order to penetrate it and create the change.
Is it really the egg like grants entry? Like it chooses to let the sperm in. The sperm doesn't just like
barge in.
Get in
right
there.
Yeah.
It has to choose to say, yes, I will let you in.
I just want you to move closer, honey, so we can make sure the microphone is picking you up.
I'm same distance. So.
Okay. Well, hold on. Say that again, Rory. You have to be so much smaller.
Yeah. I guess I was thinking kind of about, you know, especially working.
He's having like a wide, just like kaleidoscopic
vista.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he was having his mind blown by a lot of these things coming together for him.
I mean, I think that is like, when you said that, I thought about how that's sort of like a secret of existential kink and probably all effective prayer is like you... Like, when you put yourself in a sort of, like, truly humble relationship with the infinite, and you are also, like, you have a desire in your heart, somehow that desire tends to come forth pretty easily when you're in this, like, really deep, humbled, surrendered place, right?
Yeah, well, I guess maybe Layla or any of you can help me say this better than it wants to come out of my mouth, but I was thinking about...
Well, I remember you saying in the car... I remember seeing you in the car since you're beseeching, how it was like striking to you to like really think about how the like smallness of the thing is what makes it penetrating.
Yes.
Which is kind of counter to what people think of as like the masculine principle and like dominating.
Yes.
And penetrating is different than dominating.
Yes.
And dominating is like overpowering force of will. Whereas penetrating is like this very sensitive, like tiny entrance into something much, much larger.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
so
what you're saying in the car.
Yeah. And especially, you know, working as a coach and a facilitator and sometimes wanting to dom people into change and being like, wow, you actually have to like be smaller and more precise and have this like relationship that, you know, Babylon, Promethea, and like the snake, Hadith, all of that is mirroring. That's actually the agent of like transformation. And it's being like infinitesimally small in a relationship to this infinite void to like penetrate it and go in and create this huge chain reaction.
Yeah.
I think it's funny while we're talking, Lulu just came downstairs in a full witch costume.
Her Halloween costume.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And she has been whispering to me this whole time, and she came over, and at one point she said, and now I'm going to destroy the world, which is what the whole book is like. They're prophesying that Promethea is going to do in this true revelatory sense of like destroying the zeitgeist, I guess, essentially. But
well,
this
like
little tiny mini witch came in and just like a fractal blossoming of what we're talking about.
It's true. Lulu always does that. Lulu is amazing. She reads our minds, especially about the deep, mysterious things. But yeah, in Promethea, there's this like kind of Christian doomsday cult that's been...
The temple.
The temple, the sort of fundamentalist cult that's been like readying itself to fight against the forces of revelation, the scarlet woman in the sky. Oops, hey baby, here's a bottle. To fight against the scarlet woman, and, you know, be prepared to fend off the apocalypse. And it is kind of fascinating how, well, you have to read the book, I guess. Alan Moore shows us a very deep, different perspective that I love. I just love it so much. It's such a, like, warm... Like, when I read that, it just... It really opened up my heart and mind at a new level. I'm going to be forever grateful to the Magus, Alan Moore, for that... transmitting that vision so powerfully.
It's very clear it's not the apocalypse you'd expect. Which I think was awesome.
It never is.
Yeah. And yeah, I also, it was a great experience for me because I was such a big Grant Morrison fan for a long time. And very soon after I started reading Promethea, I was like, oh man, I'm sorry, Grant, like, Alan's doing a way better job making sense and, like, communicating magical knowledge and wisdom. And, like, maybe that's not Grant's thing. He's more of a chaos magician. But I was like, I just couldn't believe I hadn't read it before.
Yeah, I mean, Alan Moore is a stone-cold genius. Like, there's this YouTube documentary called, like, The Mindscape of Alan Moore, where he talks about, like, how, you know, story, literature, language is magic. It blew my mind very hard in grad school when I watched that, and it made me decide to get more into ceremonial magic. I was like, whatever that man is having, I will have that, please. And, you know, it's been quite rewarding. That was a great decision. So anyways, Alan Moore super influenced me. One of the things that I realized when I started realizing that Alan Moore was a great magus was when the Occupy movement happened, and everybody was wearing V for Vendetta masks. And it was this, like, mass, very, I mean, to me, it was touching. I don't know if it actually didn't actually do anything to hold any bankers accountable. They're all enjoying their mansions. But it did. it was powerful for me. It gave me some stirrings of hope and joy. And David and I were there, too. And anyways, what I'm trying to say is that I saw the way in which Alan Moore's V for Vendetta was a hyper sigil that brought into being this, like, whole giant, quite large scale protest movement that, was capturing imagination.
Anonymous and Mr. Robot.
And Mr. Robot, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean, is Anonymous was using V for Vendetta. V
yeah,
masks.
No, I know. That's what, maybe I didn't hear what you said. Children are talking to me.
Yeah.
I was just really, I'm blown away by, like, this, I feel like I'm deepening in my understanding of what is a magical working. And I'm like, okay, Alan Moore writing Promethea is a magical working.
A big one, a big one.
J.H. Williams III, who's the artist, like, drawing it, is a magical working. Mm-hmm. And I was reading, I was being a super nerd, and I was reading in the deluxe edition copy of the, like, how they created the final issue. And I'm like, the whole team is, like, in ritual space, maybe less intentionally than we do it, but, like, doing a magical working, and then even reading Promethea is, like, casting, like, reading anything is casting a magical spell on yourself. For and, sure. Like, that's why it's good to be intentional about what you read. And I was really thinking about this with my friend who is really into the myth-telling culture, and I was like, oh my god, telling a myth in, like, an intentional setting is basically a ritual and a magical working. And the only difference between that and, like, you know, things that I think we normally think of as more ritual is, like, in those, you're actually acting it out. Which is so cool in Promethea that, like, the people who embody Promethea and, like, transform into her do that transformation by, like, drawing her or writing a poem about her or, like, using their imagination and the logos in some way to, like, activate the Promethea entity in themselves.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's so beautiful, too, because in styling it that way, like, Alan Moore really made it this participatory magical act. So, like, in 2017, I decided to participate. I was like, I want to be Promethea. I want to scale the tree of life. Let's do this. And so I just wrote a poem, took like 10 minutes to write a little poem declaring myself Promethea. And then stuff started popping off. Like, stuff has been popping off since then. You know, with the mystery school and with, like, my own spiritual life and getting to meet... Hold on, wait one second. Lulu, mommy told you you'd need to be quiet. You could play down here quietly during the podcast, or you could play in your room. What do you want to do? David, could you maybe take her upstairs or encourage her to be quiet? Sweetie, mommy told you what the deal was. Okay, I love you, honey. You're wonderful and quite loud. Anyways, everybody, Lulu enjoys playing in her room quite a lot. She'll be okay. Don't worry. But what were we talking about? Oh, right. Anyways, doing the Promethea working. It's, I'm just What generosity. What an infinite game. You know, talk about infinite games. Like, Alan Moore be playing an infinite game. And of, like, you know, bodhisattva, compassionate invitation to play. And I love, I mean, there's so much in Promethea that's lovable, right? Because there's even, there's a man who becomes Promethea.
Yep.
It's not limited. It's not confined in any way. Like, you can be whoever you want and be Promethea. And, there's, anyways, it's powerful magic. Like, it really opened the door. So I decided to reread it recently, and I'm like, I egged Rory into reading it, and thank you for taking my suggestion, Rory.
I'm so happy.
Yeah, because I was like, yeah, I should revisit that. I remember that was a great book. Let's see what's up. And when I reread it, my mind was blown. Like, I was like texting Layla about how hard my mind was being blown, because I realized that after I did that Promethea working in 2017, I had all sorts of like crazy dreams that, you know, inspired me and led me forward into creating the mystery school and everything that were, there was some sort of time loop effect, like the seeds of them were planted in the Promethea book. Like, there's things in the Promethea book that are just like so directly rhyme with those dreams. Like, there's a scene where Hermes is talking and Aleister Crowley is standing in front of him, and like that completely connects to a dream that I had that was like foundational to my spiritual life. So like, and I'm like, wait, was that dream before or after I read that Alan Moore book? Anyways, I'm pretty sure it was after, but like, it's been this big, it's this crazy time loop, fractal, unfolding, marvelous thing. And then also, anyways, I could just go on and on and on. I was just also really stunned to find that Alan Moore, you know, obviously I read it. It's okay. Slow down, Carolyn. Great. I've had a lot of coffee today. I read it with the intention of climbing the Tree of Life and gaining a greater degree of gnosis than I had in 2017. So like I said, wish granted. I've had all sorts of really profound, mind-blowing, heart-opening spiritual experiences since then. And so I have, you know, fresh eyes with which to see and to read and perceive the magical working that Alan Moore and his collaborators were doing. And I guess maybe I'm at a loss for words. Like, my appreciation is just so vast, and I really appreciate, we were chatting a little bit about, and I don't think this is a spoiler, because book two of Promethea is a tour of the Tree of Life. It's like Alan Moore's guide to the Tree of Life. It's and he has this thing in there about paths connecting, paths crossing the abyss in the lightning flash pattern going up. Well, I guess going down or up, but like a path connecting Bina to Doth and Doth to Hesed. And I just love, I love, love, love everything that he says about Doth in there. Like, he talks about, you know, it's the 11th Sephirah, right? And the Sefer Yetzirah, the medieval Jewish text, is like very clear that like there are 10 Sephirah. There are not 9. There are not 11. There are 10. But then there's Doth.
There's a place where one should be. There's a place where one
really looks like one should be there. And, you know, so I guess there's this idea that, like, Doth is, I'm not even sure what the, who, what other magicians think about Doth. For me, it is a level of consciousness that I do think of it as Sephirah.
But it's like a clearly dissolved.
It's very dissolved. State. It's very non-dual. I think of it, you know, I think of like Abraxas, I think of Aeon, I think of, all these like super freaky sort of ultraviolet things. And
one of its qualities is that it isn't there.
It isn't there, right, exactly. Well, what Alan Moore makes this great point that, you know, it's 11, and the 11 is quite close to the little symbol for phi, isn't it? He's talking about phi or pi.
Are they the same? Phi and pi.
No, they're not the same.
Phi is a circle with a line through it.
Okay.
A vertical line through it.
This is embarrassing.
Pi looks like Stonehenge. That's what like I Stonehenge.
Thought. Look, they do say Phi later in the book.
That looks like Poseidon's trident.
Right, look, everybody, everything I know about math comes from weird hippie books. So now that is clear to everybody.
Pi looks like Stonehenge.
They're talking about pi, yeah.
Exactly. Anyways, it was real deep what he had to say about it, and I liked it.
So. Yeah, it was. I'm glad you brought this up because
it's an imaginary number. It's not imaginary. It's a irrational number. Exactly. It goes on and on and on.
And it's between 3 and 4. Just like Da'af is between Sephra 3, Bina, and 4.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That was the point that was real deep. I was like, whoa.
And it never ends. Like, pi never. It's irrational and it never ends and can go on forever.
And so, that's so amazing.
And yeah.
And that's where Da'af is. And
that was a deep. It's one of those connections where I was like, that makes complete sense. And I can't believe I've never read about this anywhere else.
Exactly.
And you also can't quite make sense of it. Right. I feel like this is like one of my favorite qualities of the mysteries is that like it is an unsolvable thing that like attracts your attention deeper inward to its spiral, but like never resolves. Right. Like you don't ever actually like solve the mystery. It's not like a Scooby-Doo style mystery where like at the end it's like revealed. It's a mystery.
God in a rubber mask.
Yeah, God in a rubber mask. Exactly. That's not how it goes. But like it's that kind of like satisfying, never ending, always unfurling thing that like titillates.
It does.
So seductive.
It is.
Draws you in. Which reminds me of like the quality of the Babylon, Nuit, infinite, imaginative, egg, feminine. That's like, look over here, little snake. Look over here. Wouldn't you like to enter my portal? Wouldn't you like to see what's at the end of this exciting spiral? Come closer. Come closer. And that's how everything seems to be created.
Yeah, you really summed it up there, Layla.
Well, anyway, it can't be summed, so.
Yeah, so what else did you like about Promethea?
Oh, man. Well, I will say that what I just said about the Pi Da'af thing, I did say after I finished to Layla, I was like, I don't understand why I'm, like, reading some of these concepts for the first time in an Alan Moore comic book when I've, like, read books and, like, researched some of this stuff at, like, more scholarly levels, and I'm like, this comic book, the CIA was right. This comic book is making it more clear and like making it, and you know, I you can't really separate your own like prior knowledge when you go in and read the thing from your experience of it. But I was like, there are concepts that are being expressed here, especially the last issue, which is like beautiful and psychedelic and just Promethea like giving a download for 32 pages about like consciousness and magic. But I was just like, this is like such a clear and good and exciting download, and I'm so turned on, and I'm almost like frustrated that other sources I've used to learn about these things like haven't communicated some of these concepts. So I was just vastly impressed. But other favorite parts,
you really liked the sex magic part, babe.
Oh, I did, yeah. So the scene where Promethea has sex with an old gross magician so he can teach her about magic, and he has her do a striptease, and as she's doing it, he's like talking about the magical symbolic resonance of like each article of clothing, and then talks about like, it was just like a deep teaching in magic, and they go through a whole kundalini chakra thing. And I was reading it, and I was like, Layla, like, we could just totally copy everything from this comic and make it into an amazing ritual. Like, oh my God. Credit Alan Moore. You know, I thought it was interesting that there's so much that happens with, it's like New York in like 1999 or like 2000, but it's very futuristic. And I was less interested in that part, but it's interesting that it's kind of going on the whole time, I guess, as like a more real backdrop.
I love the crying gorilla.
The weeping gorilla.
As like a representation of like all trashy pop culture memes.
Yeah. There is some smart stuff in there. I was very impressed. I mean, just the idea of the imagination. Like, Promethea is the sort of goddess of imagination. Like, that's what she represents. She's the archetype of the imagination. Mm-hmm. How would you say
yeah, it? Exactly. That's what she is. And, I mean, it really helped me understand Yesod better. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, just the immateria, the collective unconscious, the astral realm, you know, where place we're imagining things.
Yeah, and I really loved how when she's like ending the world, she says that like everything that exists that we're experiencing started in our imagination. And she's kind of, I forget exactly how she sets it up, but she's basically like, the imagination is the only thing that we can know for sure is real. Like, everything is imagined except for imagination itself.
Well, bro.
Yeah, I'm one of the things that's connecting to for me is, I'll have to reflect more on that. That part didn't quite sink in when I read it recently, but the something that I did think about is how, you know, basically everything that sucks about our world is like due to a failure of imagination. Mm. And if there's anything that I might get mad at other people or myself for, it is for that kind of failure of imagination. Like, there's so many people who are just like, well, here's what this. I'm just like, they just are very accepting, I guess one could say, of like the cultural limitations, like, of like, well, it's Trump or Biden. That's what it is. I can only imagine a Democrat or a Republican. I can only imagine this warmongering loser or that warmongering loser. Anyways, like, it just, anyhow, what Promethea really inspires me with is like, the hermetic ideal of, you know, in the Corpus Hermeticum, like, you know, imagine yourself equal to God. Imagine that you permeate all time and all space. Imagine that you are infinitely small. Imagine that you are infinitely large. Imagine that you are young. Imagine that you are, you know, just born. Imagine that you're dying. Imagine that, you know, it's just like, imagine, like, expand your imagination to what the divine is, and then you can apprehend God. Then you can have a relationship with the divine, but only if you greatly enlarge your imagination. And when I read that injunction in the Corpus Hermeticum, I'm like, that's what's wrong with the world, is like, not enough people are stretching their imagination of, in order to like empathize with divinity. Because obviously, like, I mean, I guess I just think about, like, not claiming that I've completely apprehended God here, but what I have done in my hermetic journey is I have gained a lot more equilibrium in my general psychic functioning and in my approach to the world and my thinking. And in that equilibrium, I do feel like my mind has become somewhat like more circular than it used to be. I feel like maybe it used to be some sort of weird warped trapezoid or something. I don't know, but it's sort of more like a nice round mandala. And I feel like it's more capable of reflecting like the great, vast sphere without distortion. And obviously it's in a limited dimensional context because whatever, but like, it's better able to reflect the sphere than the crazy distorted trapezoid that it was before. But like, that's what I feel like, you know, and that's a lot of what hermeticism and depth psychology, same, that's what they will do for you, is show you how to have a more balanced and symmetrical mode of being, so that you're more permeable to the understanding and appreciating the whole.
Well, and both, I think, depth psychology and hermeticism, and like the injunction in the Corpus Hermeticum that you just quoted, like, begins to help you identify with the like imaginal creative function itself, not just the things that it has imagined, i.e. created. Because like when you think you are your thoughts or mm-hmm. when you think you are your actions, like you are missing it. Like you are much more the thing that contains the thoughts, the like vast ocean from which all of the things has arisen, and expanding your imagination and using your imaginative faculty to like be like, wow, I could just imagine something completely different. I can imagine being infinitely large or infinitely small, or, you know, a desert or an iceberg. I can imagine all of that. Then you come to realize that like you are imagination. You are that which imagines, not the imaginative things themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm really struck right now by like the connection between imagination and desire and will. And it's like the deep like secret that is true about sort of the manifestation as we know it in kind of like pop spirituality. That's like, oh, just like concentrate, imagine the thing you want, and like that's how you manifest it. Like there is something very true that I'm just feeling into right now, where like the more vividly you can imagine the thing, at least for me, usually if it's something I want or don't want, like the stronger my connection is to it, whether I'm imagining something I really want or I'm imagining something I'm afraid of, like the more vivid it gets and the more time I spend on it, the more like real it becomes in my mind, to the point that even my physical body is having some kind of reaction and relationship to it. And it's just very clear to me that the more clear my mental picture is of the thing, and let's say it's a thing I want that like turns me on in a way that I want to move towards it, like the stronger my will is, and I can kind of feel how like, okay, we're like moving in reality in a way that like I will meet, bring that thing down from imaginative consciousness and like meet it in the material plane. And I do think people's lack of imagination is making me think of the like, yeah, that was perfectly pleasant, but I really didn't get what I want. And it's like, well, what do you want? And it's like, they haven't developed in the imaginal sphere. Yeah. Or it's like, I think, Layla, you told me this, how the Native Americans who like first saw Columbus's ships didn't see them. Because mm-hmm. they had never imagined or conceived of the idea that like giant boats could like come out of the ocean. So they couldn't even actually perceive them in their consciousness, even though they were there. So it's like, even if something's there, if in your imagination you have just never conceived of it, you like can't really even experience it.
Indeed.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, what more is there to say? Whoa. I don't know.
Well,
I mean, this whole conversation is just making me think about how, yeah, like you were saying, you know, Alan Moore's writing of this is a work of magic. Any creation of art is a work of magic, but like literally so is talking. Yeah. Like all representational communication is an act of magic, because you are like causing things to come into being in the like minds of others, and there's just mind, so like that is a creative act. Like, I don't know.
Well, this is the logos, right? Like, we were talking about this, someone was asking about logos in our mystery school group thread, and I feel like this is like a prime piece of logos.
Yeah.
Prime logos real estate.
Prime logos real estate. The imagination of prime logos real estate.
Well, yeah, the imagination used, I guess, like one of the things that's amazing about Alan Moore's Promethea is that it does give a really inspiring example of how to use the imagination towards this like rich, amazing density of meaning that is like really deeply benevolent and really deeply yeah, freeing and uplifting rather than using the imagination to shackle ourselves. Like, I heard a really scary statistic today. So, I don't know, cover your ears, everybody, if you're not ready to hear something disturbing. To me, it was disturbing. It was just that, you know, 25% of Google searches are for porn, and that the top growing category of porn is incest. And that, so my father was a pornography addict, I no longer interact with him. And, you know, I was sexually abused, and I grew up with all, he was, you know, using that all around me, and it messed me up. And it took hundreds and thousands of dollars of healing and therapy and coaching to really resolve that for me. And it did get resolved, so yay. But, like, it was a long journey. And anyhow, I was just thinking about, like, wow, that is where 25% of Google searches, you know, that is a lot of human energy and attention and focus that's just going in to... very sensational, but like not really holistically uplifting sort of direction. Not really taking into account the well-being of the performers in the films and the well-being of the families with participants who are impacted by all of that. Like, it's a very heavy duty, because I don't know. I mean, it's just sad for me to think about, because I know what my own experience was, and I know that there's probably other children being harmed by fathers and uncles and brothers and mothers and aunts who are tripping out on, like, some dark stuff that is being served up 24/7 by the internet. And also having, like, been through a healing arc with all of that stuff, it's not like I would judge, I don't know, I'm not trying to transmit Judgy McJudgerson vibes of people look at porn, whatever, but I am saying, like, that's a use of the human imagination. That is, you know, where, energy and emotion and focus is going. And my energy and emotion, I was talking from my own experience, because I was affected in this way by sexual abuse and pornography addiction as a kid. I did have, like, I used pornography in a way that was, kept my mind focused on some, you know, kinky stuff, but, like, stuff that was, you know, enjoying the idea of my own disempowerment. And funny coincidence, as long as I really was enjoying that kind of pornography and fantasy, I really was experiencing a very profound disempowerment in my life. And it wasn't until I started saying to myself, you know, I think I'm just gonna back away from this. I know how sex magic works, and I know that what I focus on when I orgasm gets created in a way. So I'm going to focus on other stuff. I'm going to focus on, you know, my love for the infinite and universal, whatever, benefit, stuff like that. And when I started doing that, there was very beautiful opportunities for even deeper levels of healing came in, and my life expanded, my relationships expanded, and I don't experience the same frustration and sense of bondage and disempowerment that I used to. So anyways, I guess I'm just using this to reflect upon, like, and put this message out there that it does matter. It does affect everything. How we use our minds, how we use our sexuality, what we focus that and direct that towards. We have creative power. We are magicians, whether we like it or not. And anyway, on a more hopeful note, there are, you know, at the same time that that's going on, there's also probably more people than ever before using really cool, far out, esoteric spiritual practices to expand their minds and hearts, because there's more translations and texts available on the internet and instruction and, you know, places like wonderful, magical courses like ours, like Battle Magic, which is open today. It closes tonight. Folks, if you're listening, you can still sign up for it. It closes at midnight tonight. What was I thinking? Oh, yeah. And so anyhow, I feel like I got kind of glum there, but I think there's major hope because I think that it takes less people in a really coherent, awesome vibration. Mm-hmm. It takes just a critical mass of us who are willing to use our imaginations and our energies in a really holistically, beautiful way to counterbalance all of that human depravity. just to get really Protestant with it.
Yeah, well, and that's like, I think, a proven effect that people who are in deep coherence have been shown to be able to impact environments of discord and violence and crime and yuckiness simply by their presence and their coherence. I'm an idiot, so I don't know the actual study, but I know that I think it was like one of the Stanford Institute studies on quantum impacts and consciousness. I'm making this up, but I know that this is like a real published study that showed that experienced meditators who are capable of bringing themselves into coherence, it's demonstrated that their presence chills things out in their environment and lowers rates of crime and violence. So it is just true that a few coherent people in the apple bucket of humanity can actually like cause
a big shift. And I just want to return for an optimistic point along those same lines back to, we've talked about it a bunch, but it was a while ago, but like the Ken Wilber talking about how, you know, there's like 5% of humanity right now at what he calls an integral level of consciousness, which as far as I understand from reading Ken Wilber and reading a lot of Jean Gebser and listening to a lot of formscapes, an integral level of consciousness involves having a perception of you know, what the Buddhists would call emptiness, of diaphaneity, of the dreamlike nature of all experience, and, you know, dwelling with that in such a way that one is oriented towards compassion. So that, so anyways, Ken Wilber says that we need about 10% of humanity to get to that integral level of consciousness in order for there to be a massive tipping point. That's his estimation, is that when 10% of humanity reaches a new consciousness structure, that's when that consciousness structure begins to take over
as the main one.
And so anyways, we're almost there, everybody. We just need some more integration, some more focus. We need to rally together and use our imaginations in a hermetically wise way. I think my take on it is to recollect our disassociated shadowy projections, whether those projections are wonderful or terrible. Because I was also thinking about this. I was like, you know, there's an, like, pornography addiction, for example, is all about disassociation. It's about like watching other usually rather plasticky people who aren't actually enjoying their lives in any way, like on a screen, and there's a frame around it. And so anyways, it's like, it's very disassociated, and it's like you're projecting your, you know, your sexual, I don't even know, haven't really thought about, but your sexual energy for sure, and your sexual whatever, like, essence out there and like putting, like, relating to it. I mean, I guess that's what all objectification is, right? It's saying like, oh, hotness is out there and I have to get it. I have to like consume it. I have to, you know, pursue it and grab it. And the alternative to that kind of projective objectification would be, you know, the deep realization of like, oh, actually the contrasexual other is within me. All of that polarity is within me. I can have like a deep orgasmic experience of divine union. All by my lonesome, just me and my meditation. But anyways, it doesn't have to be projected out is what I'm saying. The inner lover is indeed within, and that energy can be used for self-realization instead of addiction. So anyways, I've just been thinking about that a lot. I guess like thinking like addiction is something that's I spend a lot of time thinking about since I'm in a 12-step group, and it's a pretty handy metaphor for me for like all human messed upness. And because it's one that I can understand with a lot of compassion since I've been, you know, in it, and also understand, like, it is possible to heal from this, it is possible to recover from this, and it is necessarily a spiritual process.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I hear you pointing to, Carolyn, that I have also been thinking about a lot is, like, the addiction, like the way, especially where I can have a lot of compassion for addiction, not to even touch on like my own addictions, but it's like something feels good and like,
or makes something else stop feeling bad.
Right. Yeah. There's some level of, you know, in at some points sort of improvement that's preferable. And then you want more of it. And also the, whatever you're getting that state change from, it doesn't last. So then you keep going back because you want that, like, to stop feeling bad or to have that good feeling or whatever. But it's not sustainable. And as we know, it's sort of like very, very diminishing returns and even like life-endangering harm as it continues. But I definitely feel a lot of compassion for like this very innocent part of, I'm just imagining someone who's just like, that felt really good. Or like, that was a relief from Let's feeling bad. Like, I really want that. Yeah. And the challenging, I think the challenge is like, the secret is to find that in like a self-sustaining way within oneself, or even in community, or in ways that are not life-destroying. Like, you two can speak to this from the sort of 12-step perspective better than I can. But I've really been thinking quite a lot recently about this like theme and archetype of addiction, even outside of any chemical substances or alcohol or anything like that. And like the difference between continually going to an external thing to experience something that is desirable versus like finding out how one can create that experience in oneself.
Yeah. It's huge, and it is, I guess, a giant problem for humans.
It comes back to imagination, though. Yeah. I think you're right, because I think people, I was also thinking about how anxiety, like people I know who are very anxious, I'm thinking of one person in particular who's like, I'm not very creative. And I was like, but you are, because you worry about things that I would never think about. So, like, your imagination is just being expressed through your fear rather than, like, typically one might think of creativity through creating art or something. But I'm like, that is still imagination, but we have a choice. You can choose what you are, like, pointing your life force energy at in the imaginal realm, whether that's something you're afraid of or something you want or something that, like with porn, that is, like, shadowy and like kind of taboo, but you feel the desire there. And the internet's such a weird reflection of the collective unconscious, but you can choose where you point that like imaginal energy towards.
Indeed. That is the choice. Like, that is the human choice. I was like, what are we doing? I love that Dr. Robert story, that story Dr. Robert tells, which
about the little girl.
Tell the story.
Oh my gosh, this is one of my favorite healing stories. I just love this story so much. So there is, I'll just say, a woman who comes upon a little girl in a giant room, and the room is full from floor to ceiling wall to wall with just shit. And there's a little girl sitting in this room full of shit, and she's just weeping. And there's a shovel by her. It's horse shit. It's horse shit. It's just horse shit everywhere, all around this little girl. And there's a shovel near here, her, but the girl is like just dejectedly crying. And the woman says, well, what's going on? She's like, in the world, it's just this room. It's just shit. There's just shit everywhere. What am I supposed to do with all this shit? What is the point of anything? I'm just covered in shit. It's just shit. Anyway, so that's one room. And then in the next room, in the identical room, also full from floor to ceiling, wall to wall with horse shit. And there's another little girl who's just happily digging away with her shovel. And the woman says, oh, wow, this is like strange. This is another little girl in another room full of shit with another shovel. But like this girl is doing something about it. And she seems like quite fulfilled and happy and occupied. So she asks her, what are you doing? And the little girl says, digging away, well, with all this shit in here, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. And this is just the truth. Like, you can take the shit that you are surrounded by as just like the reason to quit, or the evidence,
and be miserable,
right, or the evidence that there must be a wonderful origin and reason for all this shit being here. That's the choice. And you can either cry in a room full of shit, or you can dig and search for the pony that put the shit there in the first place. And you can either cry or be occupied happily with hope in your heart. And then Dr. Robert does tell it that, like, in the end, a bomb was dropped on the building and both of the girls died. And which one would you rather be?
It's an important part. I always thought the bomb part was a little weird, but I get the point, and that is an important part of the story. Yeah. Which one would you rather be?
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, I mean, I feel like, anyway, I feel that very strongly. Like, I feel very strongly that, like, even if we were to die tomorrow, even if the whole world were to just blow up tomorrow, it fundamentally makes a difference whether we believe that we are, like, in the midst of something wonderful and exciting and, like, liberating and joyous, or whether we are, like, in dejection. Because that, I guess I know that it matters how you die.
When I was, years ago, this thought came to me where I was like, well, you know, it's sort of like we're all protagonists in our own little movies, right? And I'm like, it's really up to me whether I believe that I'm living in a tragedy or a comedy. Yeah. Because it's all up to, like, how I edit it in my mind. Mm. It's how I represent it to myself.
Soundtrack.
Or the soundtrack I put to it. You know, whether I'm imagining myself as, like, a charming heroine on a side-splittingly funny, tragicomic, profound journey that ultimately, you know, ends in ecstatic divine joy, or whether I'm just this pathetic crumb of a whatever in some sort of Beckett play, which, by the way, I thought about it really hard. Somebody gave a Beckett quote to me, and I really stopped to think about, like, would I rather have a root canal or go see a Beckett play? I once had a whole semester of Beckett in grad. Anyways, my answer is 1,000% root canal. Way, way better than a Beckett play. Bless that guy. I can't stand his view of life. But it's, anyways, it's all up to me. So I do love that. And obviously, anyways, not to minimize the very dark things do happen in this world, like we just talked about earlier. But I do think that that's like, yeah, we get to decide what, how do I say, like, it, because in a way, right.
Well, the question is, do the, like, dark and awful things that happen, does that mean, oh no, the world is screwed and I should just give up and cry? Or are the, like, dark and disturbing things that happen an invitation to create more beauty and wholeness and healing and reconciliation. Like, the thing is the same, but like, what do I decide that it means?
Exactly. And that's the whole, like, will to, like, see the world as, like, fundamentally loving in some way, even if it delivers all these terrible experiences. The terrible experiences are part of this, like, deep and beautiful story. And, yeah, that's...
So finding positive meaning.
Yes.
And that will to find, like, well, what is the positive meaning here, even if this doesn't seem good or feel good?
Like, in my dream the other night, Carolyn, when I came down the stairs and there was these two little abandoned babies at the bottom of the stairs, and in my dream, I was like, oh, well, these babies are just so lucky that I have come upon them to help them find their way home. And, like, no, at no point in the dream was I like, oh no, these poor babies, what a terrible tragedy, and just like dissolve into helplessness. I was just like, my gosh, there's little innocent babies here that need to be shepherded back to their parents. Good thing I found them. And like, carry on into the journey of finding the babies their parents. I don't know.
That is a beautiful reflection of the health of your psyche, Layla. I agree. And it does... look like we're winding down here on the hour that our podcast platform gives us. So, well, everybody, thank you for tuning in. You know that we think that you are the very coolest. Please do tell your friends and comment and like and share. And I would love for you to join us in Battle Magic if you haven't yet. As of today, which is Friday, March 1st, as... you can still sign up by midnight Eastern time. So, you know what? I think you know you want to.
I know a lot of people who are signed up for Battle Magic that are really excited about it.
Yeah, there's 180-something people signed up already. And anyways, there's a lot of cool cats from all over the world, and we're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to do weird group theurgical magic that's been passed down to me from... Florence Farr via a priestess at the temple of Amun-Ra in Thebes. So I got that going for me.
That sounds very legit.
It is.
Good source.
So legit. I hope you listening at home I hope you feel how legit it is. This truly it is. All right. Anyways, I'll let you go. Have a wonderful whatever you're doing, everybody.
I'm just imagining this podcast is a really long voicemail. All right, well, I'll let you go. Bye.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely what it is.
I know.
Okay. Thanks, listening friends. Bye.